My clock says 8:01, so I'm fashionably 1 minute late. I say fashionably because I was told that all rock stars like Beyonce and people like that, they always arrive late for their concert. That just is an expression of their importance. But it wasn't on purpose. I just had some stuff I had to do beforehand. Anyway, welcome to today's talk. And yesterday, I talked about enlightenment. What am I going to go to next? So I'm going to just carry on with the talks about enlightenment. But as I was just coming down here from my room to here, I just remembered that somebody actually asked me, can you please tell this particular story, which I haven't really fed into any of the talks yet, but it's a good story. It was a story of the first time that monkeys ever meditated. I don't know if you remember this story, but a long time ago, at Waisak time, in Sri Lanka, that many monkeys went to the temple. The reason why they went to the temple on Waisak Day, there's so many people, they brought so much food, that somebody would drop something, and that would be some nice special lunch for the monkeys, because they always brought really the best food to the temples in Sri Lanka. Not quite the same in Thailand, where we get rotten frogs and fish. You wouldn't see any monkeys in those monasteries. But anyhow, so a monkey was in the temple just waiting for, you know, the food offering, so someone would drop something and he could dash in and take a banana or a mango or something. But as he was waiting for the ceremonies to complete, he was quite close to the Dhamma hall, and he could hear the monk giving his sermon. And as the monk was giving the preaching, the monk started talking about what we call the monkey mind. And because he mentioned the monkey mind, this little monkey said, oh, they're talking about us. I wonder what they're saying about us. And the preacher, the head monk giving the talk, was saying all sorts of terrible things about the monkey mind. You've got to suppress the monkey mind. You've got to get beyond the monkey mind. The monkey mind is stopping you getting enlightened. The monkey mind gives you headaches. You can't stay on one thing for any length of time. Monkey minds are bad. And that really upset the monkey. Because they said, I've got a monkey mind. What's wrong with that? I like my monkey mind. This is actually defamation. I should get a lawyer from the UNESCO or something, or the World Wildlife Fund, and sue these monks. What do they know about a monkey mind? Monkey mind's a good mind. I'm not standing for this. And so the monkey swung back into, he didn't have any food yet, swung back into the forest where his troop lived, and told all the other monkeys, you wouldn't believe what these Buddhist monks are saying about us. They're saying monkey minds are a very bad mind. You've got to get rid of monkey minds. Monkey minds don't allow you to develop your meditation or become good people and get good rebirths afterwards. Monkey minds are bad. We can't stand for this. And all the other monkeys in the forest, they also jumped up and down and said, yeah, you can't get away with this. We've got to get some legal representation. This is the 21st century. They can't discriminate against monks or monkeys or anything these days. So they're all jumping up and down. And then the head monk, who was older and wiser, said, stop everybody. See, that's a monkey mind. Jumping up and down and complaining. He said, you'll never be able to make a case or say anything when you're just jumping up and down and shouting all the time. And all the monkeys were wise enough to say, oh yeah, that's quite right. Oh my goodness, we have got monkey minds. That's why we're monkeys. But the head monkey said, but you know, there is a way to overcome the monkey mind. And that's what that monk was talking about. learn how to sit down and meditate, and then you can get past the monkey mind. So all the monkeys were really interested. Yeah, let's all meditate. Let's get over the monkey mind. We don't want to be like this all the time. Let's meditate. Let's meditate. Come on, let's meditate. How do we meditate? What do we do to meditate? And they're jumping up and down so much, it took about 5 minutes for their monkey to say, quieten down. Now this is what I heard of how to overcome the monkey mind through meditation. You get a nice soft cushion. You sit down on it. Yeah, let's get a soft cushion. Be quiet. Get some nice soft cushions, first of all, so you can sit on them comfortably. So they all ran off into the, swung off into the forest. They got some leaves and some nice stuff from really soft bushes. And they gathered it all together. They made little saffus for themselves. Everyone made this beautiful little saffu. Some made it really big, some quite small, depending on how proud they were. Now what do we do? Now what do we do? And then the head monkey said, now you've got to sit cross-legged on that saffu. So they all sat cross-legged on their own saffu. And she said, well, now right foot over the left foot, right paw over the left paw, and just with the thumbs slightly touching, back straight, head tucked in, and then start watching your breathing. Breathing in, breathing out. And that was the first time in history that monkeys ever meditated. But not for long. One of the monkeys, you know what it's like when you meditate for the first time. One of the monkeys started thinking about lunch. So one of the monkeys put their hand up and shouted, excuse me, I've just been thinking, you know, we'd all agreed to go and raid the local banana plantation where all the owners were at the temple. So let's do that first of all, because, you know, I keep thinking about that. How can I overcome these thoughts? So let's do it first of all. We'll go to the banana plantation, raid the place, take lots of bananas, but we won't eat it yet. It's not lunchtime yet. We just keep all the bananas in the middle of the plantation, then we can go to meditate. And then I don't have to think about, you know, how to get my lunch. And all the other monkeys said, yeah, I was thinking about the same thing. So they all got up from their saffus, swang through the forest to the banana plantation. There's no one there, so they could take lots of bananas. But they didn't eat it yet, they kept their promise. And they put all the bananas, a big heap of bananas, in the middle of the plant of their little area where they lived. And they went back to their saffus. Right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, thumb slightly touching, back straight, chin in, close their eyes, and starting watching their breath. Breathing in, breathing out. Excuse me! Said another monkey, I've been thinking. You know, just before we eat those bananas, we have to peel them, first of all. So can we please get that out of the way first? So once I've peeled the bananas, then I don't have to think about that anymore. Yeah, good idea. I was thinking the same, said the other monkeys. So they all got out of their saffus and peeled their bananas. They didn't eat anything yet. All those peeled bananas they put back in a big heap in the middle of the clearing where they were meditating. They went back to their saffus. Right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, thumb slightly touching, back straight. So chin in, eyes closed. Breathing in. Excuse me! Said enough of those monkeys. I've been thinking. You know, before we eat those bananas, we have to put them in our mouth first. So let's get that out of the way first of all. Yeah, I've been thinking the same thing. All the monkeys agreed and they got up from their seats, but we won't eat them yet, we'll just put them in their mouth. They all got the banana and put one in their mouth. And of course, there are always some monkeys who put two bananas in their mouth. And one would put three. But they didn't eat it yet. They went back to their seats right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, back straight, head down, bananas in their mouth. And once everybody closed their eyes, they ate the banana. And then they got up from their seats and just swung away. That's what we call the monkey mind. I'll get this out of the way first, and then I'll meditate. That's a beautiful story. It's not demeaning monkeys, but you can actually associate what's happening there. I'll get this, this is important, I'll get this out of the way, then I won't have to think about it anymore. I get this out of the way, and then I can go and meditate. And you find out you spend the whole of the time getting meditation out of the way. And that's not the way to meditate. So that's a monkey simile. But the thing I was going to really talk about today was a bit more about enlightenment, exactly what it is. You know, you gave the nice deep teachings about being free from desire rather than having the freedom of desire, the freedom from desire. So you're sitting down and you don't want anything. Now, if I was that magic duck in that story earlier, I actually did tell that magic duck story. You all know, some of you say, how can you sell that story? Because it made you laugh. And it also had something important into it, in it. But anyway, if you were given three wishes, I said, you're a very good meditator, and we don't have to worry about money or anything. I will hereby give you three wishes. What would you want? Oh, I'll give you nothing. No, if you say that, I don't want, wanting has disappeared. You know what happens when you have the freedom to get something, whatever you want? That disturbs your mind. There was a story of these three Australians. They were just lost in some of the desert region of Western Australia. And they didn't know which way to go. They were getting very dehydrated and tired. And they found this old bottle. They rubbed it. It was a genie inside. And the genie said, according to my tradition, I can give you one wish each, the three wishes. The first guy, where would you like to be? And he said, I'd like to be back in Perth, in one of my favourite restaurants, having a lovely meal. So the genie said, okay. And so he was back in his favourite restaurant, having a wonderful meal. The second person said, oh, I'd like to be in Jhana Grove on a retreat. And the genie blinked her eyes and he was back here in Jhana Grove on a retreat. And the third guy, he said, now, what about you? What's your wish? And he said, I can't decide. I wish my two friends were back here to help me. Sorry. The wishes can be very complicated. So that's one of the reasons why. It's amazing how much freedom you can have when you lessen your desires, when they start to disappear. But as I mentioned earlier in one of the other talks, all those desires, what I want, what I don't want, we're always looking out there at the object of our desire, rather than looking at what is this thing which causes desire to happen. This other side of the hand which grasps things. And that is the only way to really overcome wanting. In deep meditation, you see this no doer there, and the world doesn't need anything. What do you want? So everything which you think you want, okay, when you're young and unenlightened, you ask the Davis for a bottle of Pepsi, and what do you get? You get too much Pepsi. You know, I'll share this with you on that wonderful range retreat where I was spending a lot of time in this bat cave. It was up in the mountains of Chiang Mai, and above Chiang Mai, quite a long way above Chiang Mai, and it was in a Raming tea plantation. I'm an English monk. The very fact of being in the middle of a tea plantation, that was very appealing for me. It's the same way why I was very attracted to Ajahn Chah. And it was really cool weather up there, high in the mountains. And it was so remote, there was only a very small village there. And they were just so happy to see a monk to feed you with food. And they didn't grow chili there. So I could eat everything. It was delicious. But one day, they gave me this food. It was like banana fried in batter. And I told them, that's really nice. As a monk, I should never do that. I never sort of say that that's delicious food. Because a couple of days later, it was one of the moon days, so I didn't need to go on alms round. They all came to the temple and to offer me food there. You know what they offered me? Fried bananas. And fried bananas. And fried bananas. No rice, no vegetables, no sweets, no curries, no other sort of fruit. Just fried bananas. Nothing but fried bananas. Before that day, I liked fried bananas. After that day, oh, I couldn't stand any. That's all you had in one meal of the day. Okay, if you had three meals a day, maybe you could handle that. But just fried bananas, my bowl full of fried bananas. The first one was nice, the second one was a bit boring, and then after, ugh. So, sometimes your desires, what you want, if you really got it, is that it? You know, I do like blessings for weddings. I remember going to this blessing, and there's a couple of disciples who come to our temple, and the lady, you know, at the wedding, after she, you know, they exchange rings, and then she said to me, because, you know, she was very reflective, she said, this is supposed to be the happiest day of my life. Is there nothing better than this? And she looked very depressed. If getting married is the happiest day of your life, it must be all downhill from there. Logically speaking. I felt so sorry for her. That's why they have to exchange rings. I don't call them wedding rings, I call them handcuffs. And I did have the nerve to tell this joke at one wedding, which I did. I said, marriage, or rather, yes, love is like a pack of playing cards. You start off with two hearts, and then a diamond. And then you get to the clubs and the spade. I knew the couple, so they laughed as well. They didn't. Well, I don't know if they minded or not, but I haven't seen them since. So anyway, where was I going with that? It's with the lessening of the desires and knowing that you don't need very much to have a very peaceful, happy life. I remember reading this one story of this a long time ago. I think I was in an aircraft reading the Bangkok Post or something. And there was this one Thai lady, and she was an office and a secretary or something, but she decided never to get married. And they were just, she wrote a little article about it. She said she can remember her past life. And she said, it's much more pleasant to have the freedom. You know, you don't need to get married. And then she could live a much more peaceful, trouble-free, burden-free life. She did that as her own sort of reasonable choice. What she was noticing, that the more you have, the more responsibility you have, the more burden it is for you. And sometimes, I shouldn't say this, but I love saying it, sometimes we, you know, as a senior monk, have to make sure that approve all these projects with so many monks. They all have their pet projects they want to do. But of course, every project costs money. And sometimes I have to look in the accounts to make sure there's enough money. And because, you know, all you are so generous, we always do have enough money. But then sometimes I think, asking you, please don't give any more donations. Please let us become very poor. Because then we don't have any money, we can't do anything. I could just stay in my cave and just relax. You don't have to get checked whether this was done properly, that was done properly, or whatever. And I'm actually being honest about that. So these days, I'm a bit unfair. These days, when we raise any money, we usually give it to another monastery, like Venerable Bodhidharma's monastery in Newbury. So you have to worry about what's going on. That's being unfair, isn't it? Monks see things in a different way. And you can see these monasteries we have here. We don't have any gold chandeliers or anything. We try and keep things as simple as possible, but comfortable. The whole purpose of these things is, you know, for your comfort, for our comfort, so you can actually meditate and let go some more. And that's really what I wanted to talk about today. I can always get around to it at the very end when I've got no time left. I actually got some time today. It's just, what is actually like enlightenment like? You did ask that question, but I never answered it properly. What enlightenment is like is you start to disappear. Many people feel these things like attainments, getting more things. You know that when you finish school or university, they give you a certificate to prove that you are attained. You've got a Bachelor of Arts. You got a master's. I still think that's very discriminatory. If you're a female, it should give you a mistress of arts. Makes more sense, doesn't it? Do they do that yet? If I had a university, that's what I would do. Give you a mistress of arts. But anyway, then you get the PhD. You know what PhD means? That was your brother told me this, first of all. Over in KL. What does PhD mean? That's right, permanent head damage. Please excuse me. Please don't say that I said that, because Ajahn Brahmadi got a PhD a few weeks ago. Anyway, it's another certificate to put on the wall. What does it mean, certificates? And because that people like certificates, another story coming, there was this place in Sri Lanka. They would have these retreats like we have here, but longer. I think there were 30 days or even 60 days, I can't remember how long. And it wasn't just meditation. You'd have like classes to, you know, teach you, you know, dependent origination or the real Satipatthana. And like the classes, to tell you about what the Dhamma is, and also the meditation. And it's almost more like a university. And, you know, you take notes, and you have to just write little essays about your understanding of these things. It was run by lay people, no monks. And at the end of the course, they would assess you. Should I assess you at the last day, on Sunday? And read out your reports. I was a school teacher before, so I know what reports are like. And I had to do them. And there was one class, I only taught them one day a week. And, you know, I didn't know too much about them. So all I did, and there was a few who really stood out, the very naughty ones or the very bright ones. I could say something about them in their report. But most of them, to solve the problem, what should I say? And I was a school teacher, okay? I wrote down all these meaningless words like fair average, okay, medium, modicum, or whatever. All the words which meant absolutely nothing. And for most of about 20 of the 30 kids in the class, that's what I wrote down. Fair, okay, good enough. Because I couldn't really assess them. It's only the ones at the top and the bottom you could assess. But at the end of the year, it wasn't just, you know, my sort of class, which I was teaching physics mostly, and they had the whole end of the year report. Many, many different subjects. And when I gave out the report cards to this class, of course, obviously, one of those children had to come bottom of the class. If they were all Einstein, if they're all going to go to Oxford and Cambridge when they graduated, there would still be one who's bottom of the class. It doesn't mean anything. But when I gave this kid the report card, you know, bottom of the class, 30th in a class of 30, he looked at it and you could see his shoulders droop and his head go down. The first signs of depression. Not just depression, but fear. I didn't need to read his mind, but he was thinking what his parents were going to say to him when he got home that night, bottom of the class. What his friends would say to him, you know, dummy. And so he felt really bad. So I paused by his desk and I said, "You've come bottom of the class." "Yes, sir." "And I know you can do much better than that." "Yes, sir." "So I've concluded by reason that you chose to come bottom of the class this year so that none of your friends will have to face what you're going to get from your parents tonight and the shame and ridicule you're going to get from your friends. You deliberately elected to take this place because you are what in Buddhism we call a bodhisattva, sacrificing your own happiness deliberately so no one else has to suffer what you're going to suffer. I'm going to go..." They all knew I was a Buddhist. And so I said, "I'm going to go to the principal, the headmaster, after this lesson, and I'm going to nominate you for Bodhisattva of the Year award in this school, deliberately sacrificing your own happiness so none of your friends and colleagues will have to suffer what you're going to get." And he looked at me as if I was the craziest teacher in our school. And of course I smiled and he laughed. It's a brilliant way of taking him out of that momentary depression. And I added, I said, "Look, I know you can do much better than this. So I'm going to nominate you for the Bodhisattva of the Year award, but I want to let you know that you are only allowed to take the Bodhisattva position only once in your time at school. Next year, let somebody else come bottom of the class." "Okay, sir, yes, I'll do that out of compassion." But of course, you know, are they really true? It means you come bottom of the class, that you're not good at anything. Doesn't mean that at all. So that's one of the reasons why certificates don't make any sense to me. But anyway, this monastery, or not monastery, it's a retreat centre, they gave these certificates out to the retreatants at the end of the retreat. You know, they would test them on their knowledge of Dhamma, written tests. They would also test their meditation in the interviews, know how deep you got in meditation. And at the award ceremony, most of them just gave the certificates they completed the 60 days or whatever. But they said, "We've got a few special people here today." And they pointed out to this middle-aged woman. And he said, "Please come to the stage." And they presented her and said, "We've all looked at your results, your knowledge of the Dhamma, and your depth of meditation. We've discussed it, and we're all convinced that you have attained to being a stream winner." And they gave her this lovely certificate, you know, her name on the top, confirmed as a stream winner by these lay people who are running the centre. "Here you are. Congratulations." And she was so angry. I mean, really angry. And they were surprised. why are you angry? Being a stream winner is a wonderful experience. It means you're never going to go back to the lower realms. You're bound for enlightenment. You can't stop it. It's going to happen. It's a time of great celebration. Well done. Why are you angry? And she looked at them and said, you don't remember me, do you? They started to get worried. I said, no, no. I was here about 10 years ago. And you gave me a non-returner certificate. You've demoted me. Of course, you can't demote anybody. But nevertheless, that place folded up a short time later. It's kind of a scam. You know, you give people sort of these certificates and they think they're getting somewhere. It's not attainments we're after. It's like letting goes. That's one of the other reasons. When I mentioned, you know someone who's enlightened, it's very hard to know someone who's enlightened, but it's very easy to know they're not. And one easy way to know a person is not enlightened is when they say, I am enlightened. If they say that, that's, you know, total certainty they're not. So how was it in the time of the Buddha that people could tell the Buddha they'd broken through and were fully enlightened? And this was one of the suttas. I love reading this sutta. And it's, for even the first time I read it, I thought, I'm going to remember this one. There was the Buddha with his attendant Ananda sitting next to him. And this monk came up to him, bowed three times, and said to the Buddha, one who is fully enlightened, an arahat, one who is fully enlightened, never thinks they're better than anybody else, never thinks they're worse than anybody else, and never thinks they're the same as anybody else. And the Buddha said, yes, correct. And the monk bowed and went away. And a short time later, another monk came up, said exactly the same. One who is enlightened never thinks they're better than anybody else, never thinks they're worse than anybody else, never thinks they're the same as anybody else. And the Buddha said again, yes, correct, well done. And then the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, those are just two new enlightened beings coming to let me know. He said, an enlightened being never says they're anything special. Never better, never worse, never the same. They just aren't. The sense of self has gone. How can you say, I am enlightened? What part of you is enlightened? What part of you can be enlightened? Is it your body is enlightened? Is it your Vedana? Is it your perceptions? Is it your will is enlightened? The will disappears. Any of your six consciousnesses are enlightened? It doesn't apply. Consciousnesses come and go. Which one is enlightened? It makes no sense when you understand what you're talking about. So that's sometimes if people ask me that question, I made that answer to them before. I said, Ajahn Brahm, are you fully enlightened? So, you know, what part of me fully enlightened? Is it my body? Is it my toes? My toes are very wise. They never make much mistakes. They're not attached to anything, not even attached to socks. Is it my body? Is it my Vedana? My Vedana, these experiences, they always come and go. Which one is the enlightened one? My perceptions, are they enlightened? They have all sorts of perceptions. Whenever I see a cup of tea with a tin kiwi, my perception thinks that's, you know, the next best thing to holy water. Is that a true perception? Do you share it? No, it's just my conditioning. That's why. So it's not truth. Even perceptions are all conditioned. Again, the will and the six different types of consciousness. They come and go. They can't be enlightened. Which one is enlightened? When you see all of this very clearly, then it says, Not better, not worse, not the same. You've seen through all of this. There's no sense of self anymore. No sense of ownership. What do you own? When you die, what can you take with you? There was this lawyer. He was a bit of a dodgy lawyer. I mean, there are some good lawyers. Any lawyers here? I always have to ask that because I don't want to be sued afterwards. This is recorded. The Buddhist Society will lose everything. Anyway, there was this lawyer. He was very wealthy. And he was on his deathbed. And so he had nothing else to do except to think, all this hard work and all this money he'd saved, now, how can he take it with him? So he got this amazing idea. He told his wife, because he couldn't get out of bed now, he was too sick, waiting to die, go to the bank. This is two big suitcases he had, you know, when he went overseas. Carry the two biggest suitcases, go to the bank, there's enough money there, and ask to fill both of those suitcases up with... Someone actually told me what's the highest currency, just one note. Is that euros or something, a 1,000 euro note?
10,000 sing.
10,000 sing, the highest. Okay. So remember this when you die. 10,000 sing dollars, just notes. So he can get as much money as he can in both suitcases. Imagine how much sing dollars you can get into those two suitcases. Then once you brought it home, he told his wife, please put it in the attic, right above the bedroom, just in the right place, just, you know, just above where my left hand is, just right above the left hand, above the left hand, on the right hand, the second suitcases. Because my plan is that when I die, when I go out of my body, on the way up, I can grab those two suitcases and I can take it with me. So it's a waste of time arguing with him. He was a top lawyer, so she did what he told her. Fill those two suitcases full of 10,000 Sing dollar notes. And millions. Put them above his bed, just in the right place. And a couple of days later, he died. And of course, you know, she was busy with all the funeral arrangements, the cremation, and all the legal stuff. It was only about after 3 or 4 days she went up into the attic to check. Those two suitcases were still there, exactly where she'd placed them. All the money was still inside. And she said, stupid husband. He should have put those two suitcases in a room underneath his bed. I knew which way he was going. So anyway, all the attainments, all the ownership is, you know, that what do you want to own things for? I know some Buddhists, they were actually telling me, it'd be really wonderful if they could have known exactly the day they were going to die. So they could actually pay off all their debts and just at the day of their death had zero money left in their credit account. They could actually use it all up. That would be so simple. Which it is. You know, a few times I mentioned to you that sometimes people do things to us. Please don't do this. They make you executor of the will. Or they bequeath money to the Buddhist Society. That is just so much work. Some people over in Sydney have bequeathed something to our Buddhist Society. And poor old Venerable Metaji, he was the one looking after this. And they still haven't, you know, got all of this stuff from them and sending letters to the lawyers. We reckon by the time all the lawyers actually tell their fees, and then there won't be anything left in the bequest. We'll probably have to pay the lawyers something. Because we use it. It's really expensive. It's also, what are you a monk for? You're not a monk to make money, you're a monk to be peaceful. Have a simple life. Be quiet. Own as little as possible. That's when people offer me things. If you offer these, you know what's going to happen to these teddy bears? They're amazing. They're very nice teddy bears. I love them. They're really good. Yeah. But eventually it'll be auctioned off to raise money for a good cause somewhere, which is nice. So that's part of, you know, what enlightenment means. You don't own anything at all. Do you own your wisdom? Is that who you are? Measured by your wisdom? I used to, you know, be a very good theoretical physicist. I remember one of the lecturers, you know, he was the teacher of Stephen Hawking. I went to his lectures as well on astrophysics of the galaxy. Such a cool subject. But now if anybody asks me any of the questions about astrophysics of the galaxy, I go, all that knowledge disappears. You can't measure yourself by any attainments. What the attainments actually do is you start to disappear. You realize you own nothing. Even your wisdom, experiences you can teach others, all so you can let go more and more and more. That's what letting go means. Disappearing. There's this word in Pali called viraga. It can mean dispassion, and that's what many people are translated as. But I would argue about that. It doesn't mean dispassion, it means vanishing, disappearing. And I'd call it the art of disappearing. That's one of the books. The art of disappearing. And as a monk, even all monks go a long way to disappearing. Just like that story, which, again, you probably remember this one. I don't know actually why I decided to do this, I think because I could, to apply for a Commonwealth healthcare card, that's for Australia, for someone who's over 65, and I was about 70 when I asked for this one, you could get a Commonwealth healthcare card. So it means that many benefits. If I get sick, you can get cheap medication. You can get other sort of little benefits. You know, looking after the elderly people in Australia. And I qualified as being old and ancient. I'm heritage listed. That's why when people said, Ajahn Brahm, you should lose weight and become thin. I said, look, I can't. It's heritage listed. You can change the inside, but not the outside. I got all the excuses. But anyway, I applied for a Commonwealth Health, and a seniors' health card. So, I went online, pressed a few buttons, and they said, I'm sorry, sir, but you need to come in personally. Because they were afraid of identity fraud. I don't know why anybody would like to steal my identity, but if you did, you can have it for free. And if you pretended to be Ajahn Brahm, you have to do all this work and take all this responsibility, and I can stay in my cave and be free. But anyway, they said, identity fraud. You've got to come into the office, that was over in Armidale, and show some identification, who you really are. So I went into that office and I sat down and the lady came out and said, ah, Mr. Brahmawangso. That's a full name, Brahmawangso. Can you prove who you are? And I looked at her and said, I've been a monk for about 47 years at that time. For 47 years I've been trying to find out who I am. I can't answer you. I thought that was funny. She didn't laugh. She looked at me, this is not a joke. I need some ID. So she went through all the list of the ID. Can you please show me your driving license? No, I don't drive. I'm a monk, simple monk. Don't drive. I haven't got a license. Okay. Have you got your credit card? No, I don't own a credit card. I haven't got a bank account. No bank account. What about your certificate of home ownership? I don't own a home. What about rental? I live in a cave. I don't pay the Buddhist Society of West Australia any rent for that. I haven't got any rental. And then she got on to one of the other things, and that just made me laugh. She said, what about your marriage certificate? I said, I'm not married. What about your work insurance or cover? No, I've got none of that either. Everything she asked, I said, I don't have. And she was getting more and more frustrated, poor lady. And then she put her head up and said, Ajahn Brahma Wangso, you don't exist. And I said, sadhu, 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 the Buddha was right. I got it confirmed by Department of Social Security, whatever it's called. All the things which define you, I don't have. And I was so pleased at that. The lady wasn't pleased, but fortunately, I do have two passports still. I have the Australian passport, because I need that when I travel, and also a British passport. I use that because sometimes, in the old days, you can get through the whole of Europe on that, so you can give teachings in Germany and other places. You don't need visas. It's much more difficult now. But nevertheless, I did have those two passports, and said, will these do? She said, well, no. Only one passport I can count, but not two. But then she said, okay, I'm going to count two anyway, just to get rid of you. It's only for a little card, which I hardly ever use anyway. But nevertheless, it's one of those wonderful experiences where, as a monk, when you disappear, it makes it difficult for other people. There's a part of me rebellious against, you know, control and weighing you, sizing you up, measuring you. When you sort of don't fit any of those measures, it's kind of like rebellious. And I kind of like that, I must admit. So anyway, that was actually proves what happens when you start to become free. You can't be measured. And that's a brilliant feeling. You're disappearing. Disappearing from all the things in this world which measure you, and through those measurements control you. You're free. And one of those things is like certificates. So at the end of this retreat, I am not going to give you any certificates. I cannot say that you're better than anybody else. I cannot say you're the worse than anybody else. I cannot say you're the same as anybody else. All I can say, you just don't exist. Does that scare you? You're not there. All I see is five khandhas, body, vedana, that's experience, just perceptions, will, and different consciousnesses playing around. You know, you look deep inside any one of those, there's nothing solid, nothing which is here today which was there yesterday. They're totally changing. This play of light. That's why somebody reminded me of that. When I think I mentioned it maybe one of the first talks, the cinema. You know, going to, as a kid, seeing these exciting movies, fearful movies, whatever. And then just, I shouldn't have done this because then the cinema never really affected me that much. You couldn't enjoy it as well. Because you looked at where those, the big monster in the movies. One thing I did find out though, monster movies, horror movies. In the horror movies in those days, I don't know if they've changed, but in those days, the monsters, whether it was, I remember the tarantula movie. There's a tarantula was involved in a nuclear accident. It was a mammoth, a really big tarantula. And tarantula would be going eating people. But it would only attack the pretty young women. The ugly ones were totally safe. And they never actually explained why. So if you're middle-aged and not so attractive anymore, you don't have to worry about monsters. They're not interested in you. Not according to what I noticed in the movies when I was young. Are they the same these days? Pretty much the same. That's misogynistic, isn't it? Usually there's somethingistic you can actually complain about. But anyway, what about the spies in those James Bond movies I used to see as a kid? I share this story with you. There's one of the monks, not in this monastery, in another monastery. He had a sister. His sister had an office job in London. Just, you know, she was okay, you know, just a young woman, very efficient in her typing. And every now and again had to go to these conferences overseas and leave for a few days. But eventually she retired. And only when she retired, she let on. The business she worked for was called MI6. She was a spy. And her brother is a monk. And he never knew. And she had this amazing ability. She could, you know, read something she'd never seen before. You know, say like, you know, Ajahn Brahm's Island Disappearing. She could read it. And she could have this, not photographic memory, but much better than that, she could understand it. And she'd go back to the headquarters in London and actually reproduce it, word for word, perfectly. That's why they sent her over to, this was the old days, behind the Iron Curtain. And they'd managed to borrow one of these secret documents and she'd read it and read it and read it and read it very quickly and get on the plane back to London. And she reproduced it perfectly. She wasn't just a spy who worked in the tea rooms making tea for all these people. She was just, just on the front line there. And the monk never knew. She looked so ordinary. And when I heard that story, and I let other people know, look, those of you in the BSWA, I travel to many countries. And I usually bring back nice big donations for the BSWA. Are they donations? And look at my tummy here. Have you actually really seen it? Do you really think it is fat? Or is it my utility belt? It would be a very good cover, wouldn't it? Being a Buddhist monk travels to many places overseas. And you do meet some many senior people in government. And they think you're a nice monk, just give them a few stories and maybe read their mind. And let the people in ASIO, that's the Australian Secret Service, know what's going on. I better not go any further, otherwise some people in dark suits will be coming through the door. They'd be quiet at your bar. Of course, you wouldn't do anything like that at all. But then if you were a spy, you'd say you wouldn't do anything like that at all. But it's nice when you can disappear and be anybody and be a nobody. So you've got nothing to protect, nothing to lose. You don't have to attain anything more in life. You don't have to work hard. Each one of you, have you got enough already? Do you have to work more to collect some more money? Get a bigger house? Mend this relationship? Do better for your society or whatever? Can you really retire? What is retirement anyway? Retirement is not stopping working. It's being able to close your eyes and stop anything. No business outstanding. To understand how that works, that quite a few years ago now, that on a weekend I'd always work in our city centre from Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Sunday come back, find out what was going on in the monastery, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, work here. I had a 7-day-a-week job. A lot of responsibility. No one else does that. You always have like weekends off or long service leave. or public holidays, accumulated leave. When I go overseas, I go to, say, like to Hong Kong, and then people ask, what are you going to Hong Kong for shopping? Of course not. I've got no money. I don't bring back stuff. Anyway, I've been to Hong Kong many times. I've never seen a shop which sells robes. The designer clothes, but I've never seen designer robe shops. Quite often you go to Indonesia. I just came back from there recently. Or like to Thailand. I went to Phuket. I said, oh, it must be lovely in Phuket. Do you go on holiday? No. Teaching a retreat. I enjoy teaching retreats. So no holiday. They go to the beach? No. I could see the beach. I could smell the beach. Couldn't touch it. Didn't get that close. But then, you say that I'm working hard, but then I decided that when I was taking somebody around Bodhinyana Monastery, and they said, what a peaceful, beautiful monastery this is. And I looked at them and said, peaceful? You don't know all the crazy monks in this monastery. I'm the one who's supposed to look after them. What about all the visitors who come? All the Anagarikas who want to interview. What about all the work in the monastery? What about all the drains which need to be cleaned, the new buildings which need to be put up, the blinds which need to be fixed, the plumbing which is broken, the electricity we have to change to make it sort of more modern, and so we get solar panels rather than spending all this money on the mains electricity? What about the cars we need to maintain? What about all this other stuff we need to do? And I'm responsible for that. I'm the head monk. I was being honest, but I realized there was something wrong with that. I could not enjoy the monastery in which I lived. I just had to manage it. So from that, I decided that every Monday morning, it was the most convenient day, on a Monday morning, I would be not the head of the monastery, not the abbot, but a visitor. I'd pretend to be a visitor on Monday mornings. So when I went walking through the monastery on a Monday morning, if I saw anything wrong, there was a tree bending over, about to fall over and kill somebody, and then somebody said, we should do something about the tree, and I said, well, you know, I'm only a visitor. I can't do anything. If somebody came up and said, that monk just really needs some advice, well, I'm only a visitor today. Maybe go and get some other senior monk who lives here, where the plumbing was broken. Well, I'm only visiting. Look, if you're visiting, and somebody asks you about the plumbing, what could you do? So no, I'm only a visitor. I can't do that. When you go to like a restaurant and have dinner in Singapore or Malaysia, wherever, when you go to the restaurant, do you ever wash the dishes afterwards? You're only visiting, you're a client, you don't work there. So for one morning a week, I didn't own the monastery in which I lived. I didn't manage it. I wasn't on the workforce there. I was just a visitor, just like you. And honestly, it was amazing, different perspective I had then. I could look at that monastery and see it just as you would, as a visitor. I never saw all the things which needed to be done in the future. I saw all the things which had been done and did look peaceful and beautiful. And that showed me your body. Are you a visitor to your body or do you own it? If you own it, you've got a lot of business to be done, a lot of sicknesses to deal with, a lot of dirt to wash off under the shower. But if you're only visiting the body, you've got no responsibilities at all. I don't have to wash my robe. It's not my robe, I don't own it. It's just covering a body which I'm just visiting for a while. And you got a cancer, I got a tumour somewhere. That's okay, I'm only a visitor. Well, that's just your body. Now about your mind. Is it your mind? If it's your mind and you own it, you're in trouble. If you're just visiting, I'm just visiting today. I don't own my mind, I'm just visiting it. Hi mind, how are you? I'm just checking in. I'll be gone by this evening. Bye-bye. Imagine you're just visiting your mind, you don't own it. Then you can actually enjoy it without possessing it. You can be free. You disappear. Its ownership gives you identity. When you don't own anything in the whole world, you're just a visitor. You're free. So, be a visitor. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.